I'm Kevin Davis, and this is the Catholic Family Podcast. And oh boy, do we have a special one for you today. It's so special that the whole thing's probably never going to go on YouTube. And well, there's going to be a reason for that, because YouTube doesn't like some of the topics we're going to be talking about today. But there's a reason why we're going to be talking about them, because really it's something that is on many people's minds. I think it's something that many people talk about around the dinner table. And a big part of our conversation today is going to be about big pharma, quote unquote, big pharma. And we're joined today by Father Stephen McKenna, who everybody knows by now. Father, thank you very much for joining us. And we're joined by Dr. Daniel Stanislavski. See, I knew I was going to say it wrong. Stanislavski, who joins us today. Sorry about that. Who joins us today to, talk about these subjects. And before we do that, of course, he's going to explain who he is, and that's going to give you a better idea of why he can talk about this. And I think that's what's really important about this, is that this isn't just me and Father having a chat. It's not just like, oh, hey, you know, a couple guys like, oh, you know, vaccines or big pharma. No, we actually brought on someone who is an expert in the field to talk about it. So please take a deep breath, calm down, put away all the things you've ever thought about this topic, and hear this out. Because again, I don't know anything about this. I'm not an expert, and I'm also really excited for this conversation because it's new for me too. So Dr. Stanislavski, please, maybe I guess the best place to start is a little bit about who you are, and then we can go into the topic.
Well, first of all, again, thank you, Kevin. Again, thank you very, very much for having me. It is an absolute honor to be on Catholic Family Podcast. It is a tremendously wonderful podcast. So thank you so much for having me. So who I am, I became a set of a contest in 2004. So quite a long time in a mission in Grand Forks, North Dakota. So shout out to all my friends in Grand Forks. As a good friend of mine, he's an absolute genius, the smartest person I've ever met in my life. When he was 19, he just through logical argumentation converted me, myself and my brother to traditional Catholicism. We started a mission there, and eventually the mission was from St. Gertrude. So this St. Gertrude's clergy has been taking care of the mission in Grand Forks, North Dakota for quite some time. So I'll maybe leave the story there, you know, for perhaps another time. But I, you know, was looking for work, and I was in college, and nothing really kind of struck me as something I wanted to do, particularly after becoming a set of a contest. And as such a young man too, things kind of seem, you know, grim, certainly, I guess is a good word for it. But I was looking for something that was at least logical and explanatory and could help people. And so I got into chemistry and biochemistry, and I didn't really know why. My motivation for it, I wasn't quite sure exactly, but I, you know, had a feeling God would use me for some good. And so I ended up getting a PhD in molecular biology and biochemistry, and was working for the federal government, which I probably should have known myself a little better, and not work for the federal government, because I'm very much against the federal government and what it stands for.
I have to comment real quick. I just love how you just casually say, I just ended up getting a PhD in molecular biology anyway, but please continue. I just love how I was just like, oh, I just, you know, ended up getting a PhD in molecular biology. I know that's easy. I'll try to do that next month. But anyway, sorry. Please continue. Come on. No problem.
So I'm working for the United States Department of Agriculture. And then of course, COVID, you know, this COVID thing comes along. And it was a very, you know, surreal time for sure. I noticed all my colleagues, you know, just absolutely 100% going along with the narrative. I, however, was reading the science, reading everything that was being published about COVID-19 since the very beginning. I mean, like, I think end of December of 2019 is when the first papers on COVID were coming out. And I was studying it in detail to try and understand, like, should I be worried? You know, what should I do for my family? That type of thing. And I came to the conclusion about the end of January that it probably wasn't going to be what was being portrayed in the media, what was going to happen to us. I wasn't really into the fear. And I, you know, of course, unfortunately, all of my colleagues, without exception, were going along with the narrative 100%. And we'll talk, you know, a
bit later on in the episode why that is. And I, of course, couldn't do that. And I love truth. That's why I'm a traditional Catholic, of course. And so I as soon as I got to a point where so what happened was, too, is I, you know, this masking story came out and we were locked down for months, just like everyone else. I've actually written about how horrible lockdowns are. And so the masking issue came up when we had to go back into the lab. We have had to wear masks. And long story short, I got in big trouble because I wouldn't wear a mask. And if I, you know, I told my boss, I had three kids at that time. If I didn't have a wife and three kids, I'd say, see you later right now. But I unfortunately, you know, kind of wore the mask loosely around my face while I was in the lab for some time. But then of course, the COVID so-called vaccines were coming out. And that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. Maybe it's more like an anvil on the camel's back that broke the camel's back. But I couldn't do it anymore because I was reading and studying in great detail how that thing works, and it's highly toxic, and there's no way, shape, or form was I ever going to put that in my body to keep my job. And I felt it my duty to in fact go out into public and start telling the truth about what this is. And so when I got to a position where I could leave working at the USDA, I did, and I became the chief science officer of a public information company called Midwest Public Health Coalition. And what we did, it was in April of 21, we started to go around the Midwest, so North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and we were giving seminars on exactly how bad the COVID so-called vaccines are. I mean, hundreds of scientific references in my talks, how bad the vaccines are, how bad the masking is for you, and that type of thing. And I know in my time doing that, I helped far, far more people than I in the year doing that than I did, and I could in an entire year of making, you know, mixing chemicals with cells and you know, making meaningless publications that like maybe 100 people are going to read, you know. So it was very rewarding in that sense. And it was really nice to actually hear people say, you know, thank you very much. You maybe saved my life and potentially my children's lives. You know, it was actually kind of nice to hear that. But then in that time, I was also, of course, working with Father McKenna because he was the pastor of our mission in Grand Forks. And the whole time Father and I were talking, it's kind of funny. I helped him do an episode, I think it was for True Restoration, about just vaccines in general. And so I helped him with that. And then right after that happened, I think that was probably like December of 2019. Correct me if I'm wrong, Father. Somewhere in there.
Recorded in January of 2020, so before the outbreak really began, before.
Amazing timing.
So I was helping him with that, and then all these COVID issues came up, and I was kind of keeping him informed. And so through Father, I helped the clergy at St. Gertrude's form their positions on what should they be doing essentially during, you know, about masking and the so-called vaccinations, et cetera, and just how bad they are. And we'll get to that later in the episode as well. But as I, you know, was telling truth about the biological realities of our world, I can't, you know, can no longer work in science because it's a very free thinking place, right? And so I got kicked out and I was looking for jobs because eventually I needed a paying job. And I tried some things on for size. I actually became a mailman for 6 months. I actually loved the job. I knew before I started that job, though, I knew because of my aid to St. Gertrude's, Father offered me the job as the principal at St. Gertrude the Great School, which I consider an absolute blessing. I love it there. I love having Mass every day. It's so beautiful to work at St. Gertrude's. And so that's kind of the short story of how I ended up here in Westchester, Ohio, working at St. Gertrude the Great. So
and along with that too is in addition to the talks that Dan was giving around the Midwest for MPHC, they also had a weekly spot on a podcast from Grand Forks too. It was a secular podcast all about things in the area of North Dakota, but more specifically the Grand Forks area and Grand Forks Best Source. And they were actually really gracious and to give MPHC a spot every week to talk about, to keep you, the public informed as well about what was all the goings on and what was really happening, and to try to help people navigate through the fear mongering and everything like that too. So in addition to those public talks, he had a weekly radio spot too. So,
wow, boy, if we had more media like that, right? Wow, that's hard to even imagine. If there was more like that, we'd have a lot less issues in our country, in our world right now. I think everyone would agree with that. It's interesting. Doctor, as you talk about this, it's like I have so many questions. Like, I want to add, but I like how you say, okay, we're gonna get that sometime during the podcast. So I'm gonna leave my questions, and I'm gonna let you continue. And again, I know you kind of laid this out talking about pharmaceuticals, and again, this is such an interesting topic for me. I'm super excited about it. So I'm just gonna let you take it. I mean, wherever you want to go with this, please let it roll.
Certainly. So I'll like to make a disclaimer right off the top that, you know, I hopefully arrive at my conclusions in a rational manner. I mean, they will sound quite extreme, perhaps, but I don't arrive at these conclusions lightly. And I also want to say I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. There's a lot of good things that the modern medical system does, including things, you know, like surgeries, certainly. The way that we handle traumatic injury is great. Emergency medicine is absolutely fantastic. And also if you're currently taking pharmaceuticals, I'm not telling you to stop immediately what you're doing in any way, shape, or form. I'm just asking you to consider with an open mind what I'm telling you, and really analyze your past use of pharmaceuticals, analyze, do they help? I mean, certainly they're very good at some things of like eliminating certain symptoms that you don't want. Pharmaceuticals can be very good at that. But as again, we'll get into later, they're not good at something called curing, right? They actually, yeah. I think it's nigh impossible for the pharmaceutical to cure anything, period, full stop. So again, that's my disclaimer. Please consider what I'm saying with open mind.
Yeah, and I think to go with that is like that understanding, like we talked about a little bit, you know, for those who watch some of the philosophy shows, to understand that difference between that objective and the subjective, you know, the objective idea that we can only, in a podcast like this, only talk about that objective idea, the overwhelming arch of pharmaceuticals. We're not talking about every single specific drug that's out there, you know, that like Dr. Stanislavski said, maybe you have something that works very well for you to help manage something that is necessary. That's we're not saying everything out there is bad. It's just the overwhelming arch. There's a patent, there's a trend that he'll lay out. So
yes. And so with that, I want to start with the background. So what setting do we live in? What is kind of the, let's take the temperature of the health of humanity as much as we possibly can, if you will. And I like to start this by saying, you know, we all know people who have died, certainly from some illness. Perhaps we all know people who are suffering currently from some incurable illness, you know, the cancers, the autoimmunities, all of these type of things. I personally, my parents both died young. My father died at the age of 49. He had multiple sclerosis, which, by the way, is a disease that can be treated with diet very successfully, actually. My mother died of cancer about 5 years ago when she was 62, 63, somewhere in there, but still relatively young. So I know two people, and I know multiple people my age who have autoimmune conditions. You know, so we all know someone. I mean, if you only know one person with these things, you're doing pretty good, right? I mean, there's so many people who are stricken with these horrible, you know, crippling illnesses. And I just want to point out too that this trend has been on the upswing, you know, hugely in the last 3-4 decades, and all projections point to that this trend of ill health
will continue. And all the major killers too, we're talking cardiovascular diseases, obesities, diabetes, cancers, all of these things, the several studies support this, are projected to explode, not just in this country, but across the globe. Okay. And so chronic, I mean, this constant environment of poor health is expected to continue. One shocking statistic, and this is actually kind of an old one too, is that adolescents, so, you know, 17 and under, the prevalence in this country for one of these chronic illnesses, these incurable chronic illnesses, is 54.1%. And that's actually an old stat. So most adolescents have some allergies, autoimmunities, that type of issue. Okay. And there's also the problem of mental health, right? Including this, there's a study that the World Health Organization put out in 2017. And they said they're projecting that by the year 2030, the number one cause of death on planet Earth will be from deaths of despair. So some form of depression, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, suicide, all of that stuff is expected to be the number one killer of human beings by the year 2030. And it's tragic. They project these things, yet they can't think like maybe we should use some different tools to go about stopping this, because clearly the tools they're using are encouraging all this. So please keep that kind of in the back of the mind. Also, you know, it's not necessarily a pharmaceutical, but certainly pharmaceuticals are involved in the procedures for abortions. Abortion is by far and away the number one cause of death in the world, period, full stop. It's, I think, I can't remember from 2023, but I believe 2022, I think it was around 45 million abortions occurred on planet Earth, 45 million. So just shockingly horrible, right? And that's free healthcare. That's free healthcare too, by the way. So iatrogenic diseases, iatrogenic issues. Iatrogenic means caused by hospitals. There's several studies on this too. One woman, her name was Barbara Starfield. She was the head of public health at the National Institute of Health, the NIH. And in 2000, she put out a study called "Is the U.S. Health Really the Best in the World?" And she found that medical error kills approximately 225,000 Americans every year. So again, if you extrapolate that over a decade, that's, you know, 2.25 million. A scientist named Makari put out a study on the exact same subject in the year about 2013, where he found that it's actually 250,000 people approximately killed by the modern medical system every single year. And then of those, it's over a little over 100,000 people are killed every year by properly prescribed drugs. Properly prescribed drugs kill a million Americans every decade. And this is lowball. This is what they can say for sure is causing it, right? So we're kind of, you know, boiling in this soup of very, very bad medicine. Very, very bad medicine.
And then, right? That also doesn't include those, like you said too, that, you know, especially during the COVID times, where they were locked into hospitals without any family or friends, and because of the low morale and loss of hope and everything like that, died of like a failure to thrive type of reality as well, which would also need to be associated with the hospital regulations as well.
Oh, absolutely. And that's absolutely true. And yeah, so like even that last study I cited, I think that was 2013, 2015, somewhere in there. So it's all of these parameters are getting worse. They're only getting worse. Nothing has changed. It is an emergency situation. It's a very dire situation, actually, and nothing has stopped this. Okay. And that's also too, there's like, I think the life expectancy number is finally starting to come down, but that was always, you know, cited as a statistic that proves that we're such an awesome medical system, is that life expectancy keeps going up and up and up. Well, there's a dramatic difference between life expectancy, lifespan, and health span, because it's another of the many poxes on our society is how we treat the elderly. We kind of shut them into homes, and then they eat garbage food, and they're just living this horrible pharmaceutical existence where they can keep this individual alive for far longer than they, most of them, want to be there. And they live this pseudo subhuman existence. So there's a difference between health span and lifespan, and health span is much, much shorter now than our average lifespan is. So Dan, the quality.
Question for you. Does that also, is part of that explanation of the quote unquote life expectancy going up due to better treatment to prevent like childhood death, like early childhood death, like as well?
Yeah, that is certainly part of that, no question about it. But that, those stats kind of kicked in a long time ago. I personally, there's a lot of evidence that shows, and perhaps we'll get into this more detail a little later, but there's a lot of evidence that shows that America is actually has the worst child mortality rate of any major industrialized nation because of certain pharmaceuticals that we stick in the arms of babies in the first hours of their life. They say, nice to meet you, we're the world, and here's a squirt of aluminum toxins. You know, it's actually crazy. And that's for a hepatitis B, which is an STD. So it's absolutely ridiculous that we're giving that type of thing to babies. But more on that when we get there. So the next major subject that I want to kind of bring up is, what is big pharma? So we kind of set this scene for the health of humanity. I suggest strongly that it is failing. I suggest strongly that it is only getting worse, certainly after the advent of the COVID-19 vaccinations, so-called vaccinations, which went into the arms of billions of people very quickly too. It's actually stunning how a vaccine, so-called, like that, could go from discovery of the need for it, ostensibly in January of 2020, to going through all the way through the research and development into production by December of 2020. It defies belief, actually, right? I mean, it actually makes no sense. Most vaccines, they have to go through at least 10 years of trial, especially in the type of vaccine that this mRNA is. Whenever there's a new technology, it's 0.2% of new technologies within vaccines actually ever make it all the way through research and development and then going into the arms of people. But virtually every single COVID-19 shot made it in 1 year, you know, all of them. Then the AstraZenecas, the Modernas, the Pfizers, the insert company here that was making them, all of them were approved, all of them went to arms. So it's amazing. But I want to talk about now, what is big pharma? Because it's not an easy thing to define. And so the way I think about it anyway, and this is certainly a subject that we should discuss, is I think it's a system of hierarchically administrated entities. So they could be public entities, they could be private entities. So think the National Institute of Health for one thing, and then they also have Pfizer. There's businesses involved, there's government involved, and indeed that's why the World Economic Forum exists, is to help bring together these public-private partnerships in order to achieve, you know, certain goals. And in this case, I think the goal is certainly to, you know, lessen the vitality and health of humanity. But these bureaucracies, if you will, again, doesn't matter if they're businesses, doesn't matter if it's a school, even how science is set up in colleges is very much part of the big pharma plan. Because what these bureaucracies do is they conduct research, they develop patents, and then ultimately they develop compounds, right? Like molecular compounds that they say ostensibly can treat disease. Okay, so that's kind of how I define big pharma. And you'll notice that big pharma is massively, massively incentivized not to cure, right? It behooves them, if they want to be financially successful, not to cure you. Okay. In fact, it perhaps behooves them, if they possibly can, to cause ill health, right? Because then they get more people that must be using their pharmaceuticals potentially throughout life, throughout the course of their life. And then after the advent of, and I you know, the mass vaccination program started in this country in, you know, the 50s. And there's a lot of mechanisms. I don't know if we'll get into that today, but there's a lot of mechanisms by which those things can cause disease, several terrible mechanisms, actually. And so after that's when you really see this explosion of what some people call man-made diseases, the autoimmunities and that type of thing, the ADHDs, the autisms, this type of thing. Vaccines can explain it all, not that they are the explanation for every single case, certainly. But when you have ADHD, I know they're diagnosing three-year-olds with ADHD now, and they give them, the treatment for ADHD is amphetamines or Ritalin. Ritalin kind of acts like cocaine in the brain. So if you're giving your three-year-old amphetamines, well, you're going to change the way that their brain develops, period, full stop, for the rest of their life. I mean, you can't really calculate what will happen to an individual child at that point. But there they have someone, a three-year-old, who is going to be taking pharmaceuticals ostensibly for the rest of their life, because there is no cure for something like ADHD. And really, when I say that, you can insert disease here. If they can sicken us at a young age, they have us and they have our money and they have us weakened for the rest of our lives, right?
Well, real quick, sorry, I just think that's interesting, because I think it's one of these things when you see so many of the institutions in our world, when it went away from being run by the Catholic Church and it was privatized, interesting. All morality went out the window, and all of a sudden they cared about profit and about making themselves rich rather than actually doing what is right and what is good. And then, of course, then they go to the schools and then they teach all the kids that the Catholic Church is obviously the big bad guy, and they've been suppressing science and all this stuff for 1,000 years. It's just like, how are people this stupid? I guess that's being too harsh, but it's just like, I guess it's because they've been taught that way. But it's incredible. Exactly as you say, it's incredible. When you just logically think there is a company that makes money from making medicine, well,
yeah,
right. Iffy.
And the way I like to think about it too is, you know, we're all set up a contest. We know that the church was infiltrated to cause the Second Vatican Council. Well, in my mind, like the Catholic Church would probably be the most difficult institution for Satan to subvert. So a pharmaceutical company, come on. I mean, like, that's got to be like easy. I mean, those things can be taken over to like nobody's business, right? So yeah, like it's to me, yeah, it's a great point. And the people, again, a large part of this, which we're about to get into, is like how people don't see it, you know. And we are, one aspect of it is that this happened a long time ago, right? We're multiple generations into this, okay? And it's so where our parents were raised, just go to the doctor, do what the doctor says, and just take the bottle of pills, make sure you finish the bottle of pills, and then just continue on as you were. On top of a lot of really bad diet advice too, but that's a whole other podcast there. Our parents being trained, and I feel bad for them, you know, the boomers, you know, they definitely should have been more aware of what's going on, but they also didn't have the internet. You know, they didn't have the ability to go out and research subjects in depth and pull up, you know, publish scientific journals on whatever subject they're looking into. They didn't have that. So it's sad that we're so far into this. So now that we're conditioned totally to just follow blindly, it's not so much that people are being stupid, certainly, right? I mean, that's there is that, don't get me wrong, but it's more, I like to think of it in a more, we're victimized. You know, we're victimized by the massive amounts of propaganda, particularly around vaccinations. It's as if people think that like angels come down from heaven and fill those little vaccine vials with the nectar of the heavens, and nothing possibly can go wrong with that, which could not be further from the truth, right?
And also, kind of makes me think as well, like you point out that sort of generational aspect of it, that those who are from that baby boom generation, you know, are the ones that got fed the most disinformation. It coincides with the fact that, at least here in the United States, that you come out of a time of World War II when, I mean, I think you could argue that blind trust in whatever the narrative that both news and government was giving you was just, that was just accepted. You know, it was, you know, that everything about it was, you know, that's how you got an entire world to generate war bonds and to sacrifice, you know, their not only their sons and husbands to go to war, but also their own personal finance and their own labor and everything about it to, and no, when you look at it in those times, nobody ever even questioned the idea of, you know, what was going on or what was happening. And then immediately on the backside of that is all of these medicines, all of these treatments and all of these things. And people are just already ready to just say, okay, well, you know, they wouldn't tell us something wrong. They're out to help us. You know, this is our, the government is here to aid us. The news is here to inform us and the schools are here to teach us. So therefore, you know, all of this falls into perfect place in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah. And vast sums of wealth went into ensuring that was the case. And psychological warfare was starting to really ramp up at that time too, against, you know, your average American, really your average Westerner. It's probably a global phenomenon actually.
Yeah. And we talked about it too in the last, I think it was in the last, was it last philosophy? One that we did, Kevin, that like the infiltration of the schools with people like John Dewey, who began to change schooling from an educational to an indoctrinational institution. So
yeah,
you know, and that's, and you know, anybody looking back, that's easily read about reality that was a direct, you know, like in purposefully caused reality that schools would be a house of indoctrination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, without question. And it's interesting too, because after World War II, that's when the federal government was really stepping on the gas pedal, so to speak, in terms of taking over a lot of facets of life, and science research, biomedical sciences was absolutely no exception to the rule. In fact, after World War II is when you had all colleges essentially start adopting programs for the new sciences then, like biochemistry, molecular biology, that type of thing, in order to really control how people thought about medicine, not just thought about medicine, but indeed research medicine, right? So within these bureaucratic institutions, like, again, colleges, like the big industries, think Pfizer, all these big pharmaceutical companies, within, again, governments, also National Institute of Health, you have within these bureaucracies, what happens is a few things. First of all, you know, bureaucracies, the nature of bureaucracy is that it is an administration, right? And the bureaucracy, when it propagates and keeps reproducing itself, it becomes stronger. The administrative class becomes stronger. And the thing that this bureaucracy is administrating, in this case, science, medicine, whatever, it gets weakened. Doesn't matter the thing. The bureaucracy essentially gets to a point where it exists purely to continue itself, and science can take a back seat, right? Good health takes a back seat. Bureaucracy must continue and become stronger. And so
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, what happens then too is that the people operating in this that have been indoctrinated to go into these bureaucracies, what happens is their behavior also becomes systematized, right? Their behavior becomes systematized because their thought, their view on what they're working on, specifically in research, et cetera, also becomes systematized. And anything that doesn't go along with narratives within these massive bureaucracies is kicked out, is wiped out, is anathematized, which is exactly what I experienced personally. And so this bureaucracy of the big pharma is obviously not just limited to medicine and pharmaceuticals, right?
Yeah.
If you consider, it's got, Father, you want to say something?
Yeah, I was going to add to exactly what you were saying. That's what I was going to insert, was that when you think about it too, before World War II, and we could probably really kind of make the delineation and connection with the Second Vatican Council before then, you know, medicine was practiced in a much different way on mass, right? So you had, what did the doctor do? The doctor was like part of your circle of people that you knew. They packed a bag, they went to your house, they visited you in your home, they met with your family, they treated you there, they came back and they followed up. It was a much more personal and a much more, you're much more invested in that person's well-being because you're part of the community, you're part of the family, you're part of everything in that regard. And if somebody needed to be, you didn't have all of these huge institutions where all of a sudden becomes, it's, you know, well, my 9:10 appointment, my 10:15 appointment, my, all right, bring the next one into the room, bring the, and it just becomes a system. Secondarily, if somebody did have to go to those hospitals, those larger institutions, you know, prior to the Second Vatican Council, what did you have? You had these huge orders of religious, especially sisters, who were trained to be nurses. And so you have all of these religious sisters, largely who, you know, what is their whole entire purpose of their life in that dedication as a sister who's also a nurse is to that point of true charity towards, you know, serving God, but by extension through serving the neighbor, you know, serving, helping, aiding the sick with true idealist purpose behind it and principle and morality and goodness behind it. And when all of that fell away, you know, the nuns disappeared and the church, you know, pulled out and these huge hospitals got erected for, you know, huge amounts of money that would come in and everything got systematized in that way. And then and to go along with the destruction of society, you started making nursing a female trade. So you bring them to move out and just have these people who are, you've done away with religious, dedicated to it, and you've now kind of started attacking even the family unit in that way, that it all really coincides together and to this whole entire corruption of it to be a systematic sort of sterile and ripe for the abuse of capitalistic corrupting entity of as an industry. It became an industry, really.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because if the doctor, you've had a couple of kids, so I don't know if you've had them at the hospital or your wife has, but I mean, for us, it's been really eye-opening that you bring them into the hospital, and, you know, you bring the woman in, she has the baby, but if it's not going fast enough for them, it's a problem. It's like, okay, hey, come on, hey, we only have so many rooms, guys. You know, it really is an assembly line, and I think, and I've heard, and unfortunately not for us, but I've heard so many stories from friends or friends of friends, et cetera, who they, you know, they went in, took too long, according to the doctor, whoever, they made them take pills that sped up the birth, didn't go fast enough, they gave them another pill, sped it up faster, and then they had to do a C-section. And it was really, it ended up being this terrible, terrible birth because just wasn't going fast enough. It's exactly as Father says, it turns into a business. It's no longer care, it is a business. It's like, okay, come on, hey, let's go, get that baby out. It's like, woof, rough.
Exactly. Yeah, it is becoming a very, very inhuman system. And it's just like all facets of our society, really, everything is kind of tending towards the robotic, you know, and it's obviously that's one of the huge reasons why health is failing so miserably as it is. And again, I think there's really no doubt about it. There's intention behind that. And that's at the higher levels, but that's for a different podcast down the road. But just kind of close this discussion about what big pharma is, think about also like where else its tentacles go, because certainly an easy one is media. I don't know why I don't watch NFL at all, you know, but I've heard of this, I think, I can't remember his name, Father talked to me about him yesterday. It's a tight end, yeah, there you go. Like, and this guy, for some reason, came across my wavelength a few times in the last couple of days, but apparently Father was telling me yesterday that this man took $20 million to advertise for the Pfizer shot, you know? So it's, again, think of how horrible that is. I mean, we'll get into the details exactly why, but it's big pharma's tentacles aren't just limited to producing pharmaceuticals. One other aspect is insurance companies.
People will get the approved treatments for their so-called diseases based upon what type of insurance they have. There's no insurance for eating well. You know, there's no insurance for exercise. There's no insurance for that type of thing. Perhaps that's an idea for a business out there. Someone wants to do that. It's like, let's insure good, healthy eating and diet and exercise. Boy, you know, things might change, you know, but insurance is now totally controlled by pharmaceutical and the treatments that they make sure that doctors are approving. So they're also in medicine writ large. The vast majority of medicine is dictated by big pharma. We mentioned the education issue. Big pharma has totally bought and paid for the medical school system, period, point blank, 100%. And I'm sure there's others, you know. And unfortunately, also big pharma.
I'm sorry, real quick. I just got to mention, sorry to interrupt. I got to mention real quick. I saw a story. There was a show that did this whole, it was all about sugar and the evils of sugar. But anyway, at the end, they showed that there was some sort of health, I don't know what company or whatever, who did a research on how healthy Coca-Cola was. And Coca-Cola gave the presentation and they said, see, this company has done a presentation. They've done the research into Coca-Cola and here are their findings. It's not that bad. It's fine. And then they scroll down in this TV show, they scroll down and it's like funded by Coca-Cola. So they literally, Coca-Cola funded the actual research into if Coca-Cola was good or not. It's totally,
absolutely,
it's nuts. Crazy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's it. Go ahead, Father. Go ahead.
I was going to say, think about how long it took and how much fighting was against the government to finally even admit that smoking was potentially health hazardous, right? It's like, I remember seeing old advertisements where it said, you know, Lucky Strikes, the preferred cigarette of 9 out of 10 doctors, you know, and it's or like, you know, some ladies prefer to have small babies, smoke Camels, you know, and it's just like, what, you know, that's, I mean, yeah, it's, I mean, it's not a new phenomenon, that's for sure. And it's, and it, again, no. It's, who's paying for that? That was the tobacco industry, or, you know, who got us to have grain all at the bottom of the food pyramid? That was the grain industry, you know, and for all of that. And it wasn't based on health, but it was promoted as health, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That, like you said, it's a very old game. A man named Edward Bernays is considered one of the fathers of modern propaganda. Certainly, he was the guy that was like, hey, let's have James Dean hold the pack of Marlboros and Coca-Cola or whatever, right? It seems simple now because we've been inundated with it since, you know, our first moments of life. But back then, it was a big deal. But this guy also worked for big, big companies like Alcoa, the aluminum company of America. What happened is one of the byproducts of the production of aluminum was sodium fluoride. They were dumping fluoride into a river, which was the water source for the local community. And all this local community started getting very, very sickened by it. And Edward Bernays said, if you want people to believe anything, you just have them say, you know, have your news program or commercial or whatever say, scientists say this, research shows this, this many doctors promote this. Well, needless to say, he funded a lot of bad science on fluoride. And this is where we get the idea that fluoride is good for your teeth. Because before then, they were proving definitively that fluoride actually causes teeth modeling, the formation of cavities and decaying teeth. But now the opposite is the common understanding is that fluoride is good for your teeth, for example. And that's all from really, really bad science 100 years ago to cover the Aluminum Company of America's behind in court. You know, and that tactic, that technique of propaganda, which is to say mind control, has been used since then professional, getting more professional, more scientific all the time. But that's actually a really great segue into kind of the next aspect of this as well. And that is, I want to talk about what are pharmaceuticals, because it's really important for people to understand. And so I mentioned the patented compounds, like what these bureaucracies are, and like end of the day, what they're trying to produce is some form of compound that they want you to be taking to ostensibly treat some disease you have, right? And so that's kind of how I define pharmaceuticals, is, you know, something that goes into your body. And even there, you know, when I sit and I muse about these things, I think maybe there are things that don't necessarily need to go directly into your body that can produce chemical changes, thinking mainly of like television, digital things. When you go into your eyes, they cause very specific neurochemical reactions to occur. But most generally, pharmaceuticals are compounds that go into your body to treat something, right? And it's very, there's something that's called the mechanism of action, okay? And that is how said pharmaceutical works within your body to achieve its goal, okay? And before I actually get into mechanism action, though, I think it's really important to understand the major sources of disease, okay? Because disease is really caused by only a few things. One is a genetic mutation, okay? Genetic mutations, so that'd be a change in your DNA. And what a gene is a section of DNA that eventually becomes a protein. And a protein is essentially a little micro machine in your cell that does some function for you, okay? And if some proteins are very important, and if you have a mutation in a gene for that protein, and you make misfunctioning proteins, that could kill you. I mean, there's no question about it. Or if you do survive with that, you could easily cause disease. The prevalence of mutations causing disease is very, very minuscule. It's really not the source of disease en masse. It does happen, but it is rare. And there is no pharmaceutical on planet Earth that can go into your genes in all of your cells in your body and then fix your gene mutation, right? Doesn't happen, doesn't exist, period. The other major source of disease would be being chronically exposed to deleterious stimuli, bad negative stimuli going into your body, or you being exposed to it day after day after day, hour after hour, potentially year after year. That is by far the main source of ill health and what we know as disease, the cardiovascular diseases, the obesities, the cancers, et cetera. That is the main number one reason for it. Now, again, though pharmaceuticals and the use of pharmaceuticals is certainly a behavior, and potentially even if we consider it as a positive behavior, it does not remove this negative behavior, this negative stimuli that you're exposed to. So if you're kind of putting these pharmaceuticals into your body that are just meant to kind of stop disease, but the disease is being sourced from this negative stimuli or behavior that you're doing to yourself, mostly it's, eating a very poor diet. The Western diet is a field ripe for producing disease. Again, that's another podcast episode down the road, perhaps. But there's no way that you're really going to ever cure yourself taking a pharmaceutical if you're this negative stimuli is coming in, right? And so pharmaceuticals, to my mind, and I was learning this stuff, right? I was taking pharmacology classes and, learning that these compounds, you take them, and most pharmaceuticals operate through, talk to what's called a receptor or a transporter on the outside of your cells, and then they tell these cells to do something or stop doing something, right? Again, doesn't remove the disease origin, period, point blank. They can't. And so I was sitting here thinking, like, when I'm in taking these classes, just the very first principles about how pharmaceuticals operate, I think one can safely deduce that it won't cure. In fact, I think I go as far as to say I think it's impossible for it to cure, though maybe there are some exceptions to that. And then also, as I mentioned earlier, again, like, you have these pharmaceuticals going in and properly prescribed pharmaceuticals also kill a million people every decade, right? Low on the low end, and just in this country. So there's this really, it's a really poor cost benefit ratio, I think, in a sober analysis of what's going on with pharmaceuticals. And then add on top of that, like, what I was giving seminars on, and this novel technology that is the COVID-19 injections. It's truly, so this one is mRNA technology, okay? It's not a vaccine, it is certainly a gene therapy. But the word therapy has the connotation that it's somehow good for you and it's going to improve your health, which is So far, with the COVID-19, from my assessment, is disastrously incorrect. And so what I was doing there is in these seminars, I was explaining the mechanism of action, like how these things work, just by what they're telling us, just by how they say it works, we can conclude that it has high potential to, if not cause serious harm, to kill you. Okay. And so, and to understand this, like that, you have to understand the what's called the central dogma of biology. Usually that subject, the central dogma of biology, is introduced in the infamous seventh grade science class, I like to call it, where they tell you that God isn't real and evolution is, you know, the only thing that matters. It's the only explanation for how we got here. And what the central dogma of biology is that DNA becomes RNA, specifically mRNA, and then that mRNA becomes protein. Okay. So with these injections, they're essentially loading you up with this mRNA. And this, by the way, there's a lot of genius technology that went into making this thing. So there's no way they didn't know what I'm about to explain to you. But they're loading you up with this mRNA, again, beautifully designed to make sure your body doesn't destroy it, and to make sure it lasts a really long time so it can keep making the protein it's designed to make, and that is the spike protein. So if you recall back to the images of the COVID-19 virus, the computer-generated images, of course, of the COVID-19 virus, those like those big nodules on the outside covering the virus, that is the spike protein. And with modern technology that we have, we can isolate the genetic sequence of the spike protein, and then scientists can make that spike protein in whatever system they want to make it in. Doesn't matter. Let me tell you, it's been studied even before I've done. I actually stopped looking at COVID-19 stuff because I didn't care. I wanted to move on and, you know, and advance my knowledge and understanding of what's happening in this world. But even when I was done looking at this stuff, I can't even tell you hundreds of journals, journal articles, research studies were published in reputable scientific journals on what this spike protein does. Okay. Again, the goal of this shot is to make your body into a manufactory for the spike protein. Now, without fail, every paradigm that they study the spike protein in, the spike protein kills it. It weakens the blood-brain barrier. It goes into your brain. It can cause brain inflammation. It destroys blood vessels, endothelial cells that surround your blood vessels. It can bury in there, destroy blood vessels. It gets into your heart. It destroys your heart muscle. Guess what? That's myocarditis. That's a perfect explanation for myocarditis. I was predicting, again, just based off how the spike protein works, I was predicting everything that we now know for fact that it does. Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, spike protein is also a prion protein. These Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, these things are also prion-like diseases. And the spike protein was shown specifically to bind to these prion proteins that cause these other diseases. And you can cause buildup of these prion proteins, which is a source of disease. So if we start to see 20-year-olds, 25-year-olds, 30-year-olds getting Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, which are traditionally end-of-life diseases, we know what's doing it, right? We know what's doing it. And you name it, cancers. This thing is designed to cause cancer, you know? And so you can extrapolate that very, very, very easily just by understanding how these shots work. Go ahead, Father. I think
you're gonna... And I was going to add to that too. We had talked about way back when as well, and something that overarching aspect too that comes was the idea of the development of autoimmunodeficiency syndrome as well. And so mm-hmm. that's why the talking point becomes sort of like the excess mortality in society and everything, because people are dying of like colds or diseases that, you know, might just be listed as the cause of death, but it's caused by the fact that immune systems are shutting down from it as well. And that you're having an inability to fight off what a body normally would have been able to successfully conquer too. So.
Oh, absolutely. And they were saying that the immunocompromised are like the people that should be getting this thing first when they were rolling it out, which is, again, it's absolutely the opposite of the truth. And that's another again, I went into great detail. If you want to find the seminars online and check it out that I gave, autoimmunities, there's a lot of parts of this spike protein that are very similar, if not identical, to large stretches of human proteins. So if your immune system's learning to fight the spike protein and it sees this exact part in some other protein in your body, your immune system is going to attack that other protein in your body somewhere, perhaps in some vital organ as well. So this thing, I mean, there's really no question about it. The COVID shots are tailor-made weapons to destroy human health. And that's why it's very important to educate yourself on mechanism of action. I think, you know, it shouldn't be this way. If we lived in a Catholic world where you should be able to just go to the doctor and trust what they say, that should be how it works. But unfortunately, that is not even close to how it works anymore. So it behooves yourself to have some knowledge of biochemistry. And then if you're taking a drug, look at just, you can Google search it, go to Google Scholar, put the name of the drug in and just type name of a drug and then mechanism of action. And you can probably put it in Google search too. And you can, most published research is free to download. And so you can download it and just start working your way through it. It really does, you know, it could save you, honestly. It could save your life. It could be what's causing, you know, these drugs could be what's causing your ill health. So perhaps it's worth considering and taking the time and doing some legwork into researching what exactly is going on with these things. So.
And so real quick, and do you think if someone got, let's just say one shot, you know, they got one COVID shot and then never booster or anything, they only got one, do you think it's possible that it still could have long-term effects, that it someday it'll come and strike him down? And if you think that's the case, is there anything you can do, or is it just kind of, whoops, well,
yeah, no. I'm not, yeah, the human body is very, very plastic and is rugged. It can survive a lot. So I'm not one that thinks that if you took a shot, it's going to kill you. I don't think that for a number of reasons, even down to things like most of these shots came in vials that contained 6 shots per vial. And so like what the nurse pulls out before they squirt it into your arm, it's going to be random unless they have what's called the vortexer, where they can really mix perfectly what's in there. I mean, if you get the first shot, it's a busy day, the nurse doesn't shake up the vial well, you're pulling off the soup from the top, you're not really getting any of the nasty stuff that settles at the bottom, then maybe you're fine, you know, who knows. There's also the theory that was posited that some of the vials actually contain saline and not, you know, the toxic stuff. So I'm not sure where I stand on that. But I think it's certainly possible to survive. And there's also the factor too, one aspect of vaccines that really make them evil genius type stuff is that the symptoms that manifest themselves are going to be based upon where the bolus of injection ends up in your body. So the symptoms you're going to have, if it goes to your brain, you're going to have, you know, neurological symptoms, you know, the Alzheimer's or autism's, ADHD's, that type of thing. If it goes to your heart, you're going to have heart problems. If it goes to your bowels, you're going to have bowel problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the reason I'm saying that is if vaccine damage manifested itself as one thing every single time, it would be obvious, right? If it was just always autism, it'd be obvious, right? But because it depends upon where the poison goes into your body, you're going to have a whole panoply of potential symptoms and thus diseases that are going to be associated with it. And so if you happen to get a shot into your muscle and it just stays in your muscle, you're probably going to be just fine. So.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I could probably say the question for the end. I'm really curious about, because you kind of talked about it a little bit earlier about the beginning of vaccines and how medicine changed back in the day. Because for me, I'm really curious about polio. But I'll let you either answer that or move on, because I think that's also a rabbit hole, obviously. But because to me, it seems like I've had friends who are nurses or worked in the industry, and that was what they always kind of went to. Like, look, you know. That's kind of where it started. That's the absolute definitive proof the vaccines work. And that was just kind of it. Like, I couldn't even get past that. It was like, nope, see, here's the example. Polio worked. Doctors and scientists are They understand this. They know what they're doing. And so just be quiet and take your vaccine. And again, you can answer it or you can move on. I'll let you decide.
Yeah. I'll get into it. It seems like Father has something to say, maybe.
Nope. Sorry. Oh.
Okay. Yeah. So
that is my indicator, but I just was thinking.
So the man who came up with the polio vaccine is a man named Jonas Salk. Jonas Salk wrote books. One of his books is called The Survival of the Wisest, The Survival of the Wisest. In it, he says that there's a new type of evolution that is occurring before our very eyes. And that is a survival of those with intuition, those with wisdom enough to survive. Okay. The book is without question a eugenical Malthusian creed. I mean, it is no question about it. He was one of those guys. And when you get to the upper echelons of the medical establishment, to a man, that is the case. They are all Malthusian. They are all eugenicists. And the polio shot that he rolled out was a live virus vaccine. Thus, getting the shot means you're putting the virus into your body, meaning if the virus is actively replicating within you, you can easily spread it to other people. Okay. There was a woman, and I forget her name, who was also working at the National Institute of Health at the time. And she discovered that the Salk vaccine had also another virus in it called SV40, simian virus 40, which is a highly potent carcinogen. Now, the CDC used to have on their website data on tumors. And what they found is that, I forget the data actually, because it's been a long time, but they took it down in like 2013, I want to say, something like that. Took it off their website. They expunged the history, so to speak, because they found that simian virus 40 genetic material in tens of millions of American cancer tumors. So you have this interesting dynamic about polio. Shortly after polio, by the way, polio, this is the case for all of the vaccines that were put out in the market in the 50s, okay? We're on the massive decline, basically down 80% from their highs. This is due to improving sanitation, the improving soap, nutrition availability at people's fingertips, right? So basically the number of the polio incidence is collapsing down to zero, gets like 80% gone, maybe even more, 90, and then they start the shots, it goes to zero, and they're like, oh, look what the shots did, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time, they also changed how they diagnose polio, and it went from like impairment or paralysis of limbs to up to like 6 weeks, maybe even 6 months. Sorry, I haven't thought about this in a while, but they narrowed it down to 2 weeks, 3 weeks, right? And then they also, a new disease cropped up at that same time, which they started defining as well. Instead of calling it polio, they started calling it Guillain-Barré syndrome, which perhaps people heard of. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of little pieces around the polio story that in my mind say that polio was already on the way out. They changed how they diagnosed it, and then they substituted polio for cancers and other horrible, horrible diseases that have maimed American culture.
Isn't it true, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, I'm just trying to remember some of the stuff we talked about. So just as pointing out that when you say that they found SV40 in all those cancer aspects, that the simian aspect of it is the key part to identifying that it's not just something that randomly occurs in your body, right? Because that is something that comes from monkeys. Am I correct in that?
So go ahead, Father. Sorry.
So that, yeah, that like it would only come in if it was foreignly introduced, i.e. through the means of the polio vaccine.
Exactly. And I forget that I almost mentioned, I forget her name, but check her out. She was a woman working at the NIH in the 50s, a researcher, brilliant lady. In fact, when I was at the USDA, you know, like the federal government, they beat you over the head with the leftist agenda. And they were like, they'd like make you give presentations on women in science and also like minorities in science. And I wanted to give a presentation on this woman just to be like, hey, look how bad vaccines are, you know, and just be fired instantly, you know. But she revealed that, you know, this SV40 virus is in all of the Salk vaccines, which are now going into millions of Americans' arms. And so, of course, they didn't kill her, but her career was curtailed, so to speak. And so, there's a long history and a dark history, certainly, behind the mass vaccination. And Jonas Salk, too, is considered, you know, he's amongst the pantheon of the modern medicine lowercase g gods, right? I mean, people revere him. There's large research institutes, you know, that have his name on them. And all they got to do is read his book. You know, it's like he's telling you, he's not hiding what he is and who he is, but people refuse to see it because we're subjected to such strong propaganda from birth, ideally to death. So that's kind of all I really, I mean, if you have some more questions, all I have to say on the subject, I guess the way I wanted to conclude it is kind of a meme, you know, and it's no longer the case here now that I live near Cincinnati, but you know, back where I was from in North Dakota and a lot of places in Minnesota where I would, you know, spend lots of my time, a trend I noticed is that the largest buildings in these towns were becoming hospitals, right? I mean, as my wife is from Duluth, Minnesota, when we visit Duluth, they're building this huge monstrosity of a hospital. And, you know, just logically thinking about this, if we're sitting here at the cutting edge of science and we know all these beautiful biomedical techniques and we're on the cusp of greatness and just like a utopian health situation, these hospitals should be getting smaller. We should be eliminating hospitals. They shouldn't be getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So next time, you know, when you're out driving around and you see these mammoth sized hospitals, just think about it. Think about the total, you know, indoctrination that must go into the researchers and the doctors and nurses and stuff that are going into working in these places. So,
and also to go along with that is the idea that, you know, 150 years ago, you know, it was always the indicator of what was most important in the eyes of society too, right? 150 years ago, the largest building in any given town or city or whatever was always the churches, you know, and those were always the most important thing in the eyes of the people. It was in the center, it was the biggest. And now, like you said, Dan, it's, you know, it's two things. It's hospitals and it's banks.
And yep.
The two.
Next time on
sporting stadiums, Father. Sporting stadiums. That's another one too, because that's the circuses, right? No, but you're absolutely right. Those three things. It's the bread and circuses, and then the hospital. I guess it kind of makes sense. No, absolutely fascinating stuff, Dr. Stanislavski. I really hope to have you on again, both of you. I think what I would love to talk about there's so many things that came up in my mind that we could talk about, but I'd love to talk about how to live a healthy life. Because we talk about kind of all the negative, you know, kind of the, okay, you know, this is how you get sick and this is, you know, how you get sicker or don't get healthier. And I think, because that's the brighter side of it, because there is a way. I think as you mentioned very briefly, okay, you know, just kind of get away from the bad stuff that's likely to make you ill, right? I mean, it's it sounds extremely easy. And I just today ate like two donuts and, you know, I mean, okay, it's the day before Ash Wednesday, so I can be forgiven a little bit, I hope. But still, you know, it's like, you know, it's funny because it's like, you know, I'm such an idiot with what I put into my body. And it's like, okay, well, I know it. I know it should be something that I should do better. But that would be a really good podcast. And there's so many other, I would love to have you on again. And I hope anyone watching this, please let us know if the doctor would be good enough to come on again. Let us know what you'd like to hear too. Because I mean, I love this. That this is exactly what I hoped it would be. Someone who's well spoken, studied this stuff, and is not just a guy, you know, sitting behind a microphone talking about it. And I think that's, we need more of this. We need more of this type of conversation, and we need more of a Yeah, as Francis would say, a dialogue. We need to dialogue more on these issues. So anyway, I guess leaving it on that note. I don't know, Father, if you have any last words before we head off.
No, I think this is very well done, very well presented. It's that reality that it is. If that time period in of 2020 and onwards has taught us anything about this aspect of pharmaceuticals or industries that are connected with government and things like that, it's that we have to be critical thinkers. And that's why, that's why it's important to have people like Dr. Stanislavski on. It's also important why, like, some of the aspect of what we're doing with, like, the philosophy stuff comes into play, understanding what is going on, what is, how we're corrupted or made to think, and that we just keep learning about these things, because then and adapting ourselves, withholding preconceived notions and following what is logical in that way. I think that's such an important part, and to be able to keep providing that. So
absolutely. And we'll do our best to get the links to the doctor's previous material. That sounds good. It sounds like something I want to watch as well. And we'll play it. Have you written a book or anything? Is there anything I can link people to, Dr. Stanislavski?
Not yet. I'll give you a link to the podcast sure. That I've done. It's a definitely very different subject matter. Each episode is very deep stuff. It's also very much PG-13 because it's very, very serious subject matter. But I can send you the link to that playlist. But working definitely, on writing stuff about this.
Yeah. Definitely include the stuff to your hidden open secret stuff too. That's as well. Because those are really informative, really powerful, and Dr. Stanislavski does the legwork by reading the book for you and then giving you the Reader's Digest version of the information that's pertinent inside it. So,
awesome. I'd also like to say one more time, I'll say thank you, Kevin. Thank you so much for having me on. It's been an honor, super blessing. So, thank you very much.
Whew, boy, my pleasure. Let's do it again. Thank you both, too. God bless you both, and I guess stay healthy and God bless everyone. And please, everyone, please like, share, subscribe, all that stuff. Comment, let us know. And again, this is the whole thing's certainly not going on YouTube. We'll put it up on Rumble. People on Patreon can obviously view this as well. And let us know in the comment section, what would you like if you want the three of us to talk? And I'm sure Dr. Stanislavski is clearly an intelligent man. What would you like him to talk about? It doesn't have to be biochemistry or something. It can be something else. I mean, I'm sure we could sit down and talk about, I guess not football. We can't talk about football, but we'll find something else. Let us know what you want to talk about in the comment section. We'd love to do it sometime here in the near future. Until then, Father, Dr. Stanislavski, God bless you.
Thank you.
Thank you.